Welcome to the second episode for 2016 of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. If you're familiar with the podcast or just joining in and this is your first episode, you may know that you can find it at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and also on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. The latest guest is a veteran, people, in the industry, Diana Foe, who is associate editor at A Big Five. And for those of you in the sci-fi, fantasy, steampunk community, you may very well know Diana from being the founder of Beyond Victoriana website. And she has been the organizer for the Geeks of Color panel at New York Comic Con for the past 3 years. And you can see 2014 and 2013 on YouTube right now, and 2015, I guess, is on its way, since it was in fall and all that stuff. So welcome, Diana Foe. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jen.
You know, and most people know, the first question.
Right.
But it's different for you also because you've been in a few positions in publishing, and it seems like this is a track that you've wanted to be on. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong in that sense. I don't know where you first heard about publishing or if really this is something that has always been something you wanted to do, but you didn't have an inkling as to how to do it. But you also were talking in one of the New York Comic Con panels about being introduced to the genre that you represent so well. It was because of Animorphs.
Right. Well, it was actually the book series. I didn't grow up with cable, so Nickelodeon was a mystery to me. Rugrats, I had no idea who they were. But I think that probably helped me in the long run, you know? I've been in publishing for 8 years, and I guess that does qualify for being a veteran.
I think so, especially at our age.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I feel like so many people tend to leave within the first 3 years.
It's a tough industry. And also, I think that if you start publishing young, like right out of undergrad, there does come a point when you have your mid-20s crisis, and you're like, what am I going to do with my life? I'll go back to grad school.
Yeah.
And then they leave and never come back. That's what usually happens in publishing, you know, if you start when you're younger. But I started off, you know, right after undergrad, and I was an English double major with Russian in college.
Wow.
So when it came time for job hunting, I had, you know, two options. I could either get my master's in English and go into education, get my master's in Russian and work for the private sector, or do something else entirely different, which is actually a third option I never even thought about until it actually happened. So I did think about publishing, you know, as an option because, you know, I loved books, and it's also one of those industries that really appreciates all sorts of different types of backgrounds in terms of education. So it didn't matter that, yeah, you know, I had Russian and I could speak it, and I lived in Moscow, even though it did actually help in the long run.
Everything seemed, when you went on interviews?
Yeah, everything seemed to like coalesce into one big pathway. But when I graduated, I actually, in my senior year, I did a couple of internships that really helped. But both of those internships were actually for marketing.
Yeah, that's where I saw you started at.
Right. Yeah. And I had an internship at Kaplan where I, like, I copy edited, you know, test packets and read terrible, terrible student essays for one summer. And I also did a very short internship at John Wiley & Sons. And so when I was doing my interviews, my first position in publishing was actually in international sales and marketing as their marketing assistant. And, you know, I was called specifically because I had international experience because of my, you know, my dual degree and the fact I studied abroad in Moscow. And, you know, and the fact that I had internships in marketing. And so I worked at Hachette for 2.5 years. Then I jumped from there into sci-fi. I took an editorial position at the Science Fiction Book Club, worked there for a while, and then I had my mid-20s crisis and thought, oh my gosh, what is there to life? Let's go back to school. And I actually got my master's in performance studies at NYU. And my final project actually was about steampunk performance and subculture. So the geekiness was just something that ran throughout my entire life somehow, one way or another. And at the same time, while I was in grad school, I took a job doing social media stuff for Tor.com.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, you know, I did some blogging for them. I ran some major events. They used to have, you know, steampunk-related events that would last for like a month or a fortnight. And I would be the organizer for that. So when I graduated and I realized, no, academia is not for me, thankfully, a position opened up at Tor. And so I got that job specifically because there was also a hybrid position. It was editorial, but there was also a huge marketing component. One of the other hats I wear is that I'm the distribution liaison for Seven Seas Entertainment, which is the manga publisher that that Tor distributes for. So my job has been like very varied, and it ranged across, you know, the board. But I think that everything that I had done in my previous position or previous experience actively contributed to my next one.
The biggest point is also that you knew about publishing in some way or fashion. How did you know about publishing?
And I think it was helpful that my undergrad, I'm a Mount Holyoke alum, and you know, have a huge focus on, you know, liberal arts education and, you know, a very strong alumni network. And I would have never known about publishing as an option if I didn't find other alumni that worked in the industry. And it actually had been super helpful too. You know, and I credit a lot, you know, of other women who've helped me, like, you know, get jobs, you know, in the publishing field, you know. And, you know, and the first couple ones were people with, like, who, you know, were also working at like John Wiley or Kaplan and said like, hey, we're looking for interns, you know. So, and it was that, and also Mount Holyoke was a school that really supported their students through scholarships. I would have never been able to intern at New York at all if Mount Holyoke didn't give me a scholarship to go.
Oh, really?
Wow. So, and I think that's also, I'm sure we're going to talk more about this later, but I think one of the things that people are addressing in these conversations about representation and, you know, and being able to enter the field of publishing, if you are from a disadvantaged background, is how important it is to find those organizations that support, you know, specifically underserved communities.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that, in, and not only that, but like to foster that the people in those communities, like, you've benefited from the organization, but now it's your responsibility to carry the torch and to help people, you know, who are in similar positions also, you know, get into the field and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. Scholarship. I know this is a podcast, but my eyes kind of bugged out when she said that. I said, what? That's insane. But that's awesome. And it's sad that it's kind of unheard of too.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it does talk to the larger problem of who's getting these positions, who can afford to get to the positions, and the economic disparity as well as the racial disparity. So I remember in one of the panels you moderated for New York Comic Con, since you're pretty much becoming a veteran there. So you, like we said, with the Animorphs, and then, you know, being part of the steampunk community, doing the art, you know, your final project on that. How was it, especially because when we talk about the whole diversity, umbrella term diversity, how underrepresented the POC, LGBTQ, and disabled communities are also in the sci-fi community. So how, even with there being those connective threads, how did you get into the fandom? Even if there is still elements of the underrepresented, is it really the story that's always carried you in, or just the specificity of what you were looking at that really spoke to you?
I think it's both, but I also think that depending on how, like, there's a, like, when you're a kid, you know, there's stuff that, like, takes your interest and might come into your life for several different reasons. Like, your friends might introduce you to it, you might see it on TV, your librarian or your teacher might, like, you know, have it in the classroom. I was a library kid growing up, And, you know, and so my librarians would specifically say, like, you should read X, and they would give me something, like, you know. And and we were a part of summer reading programs where, mm-hmm. like, you know, if you read, like, X number of books, you could get a prize. And, of course, materialistic children everywhere were like, yes, I would love this, like, $2 prize I get for, like, reading three books. But what got me into Animorphs specifically, you know, was I was really obsessed with animals. Like, I'm sure most kids would be, like, obsessed with, like, animals, but also, you know, aliens and the fact that, you know, it would, you know, when I'm older and I'm thinking about what are the things I really loved as a kid, I realized, like, whoa, this is, like, really potentially dark stuff, because when I was, like, you know, 10, 11, you know, years old, I was reading about child soldiers fighting secret alien invasion and how that was, like, really, like, dark and traumatic, but also they had really, like, funny and weird and quirky adventures, too. It one of the benefits of a serial is that, you know, you can have really dark, serious books, and then you can have really, like, lighthearted, you know, adventure books, like, one after another. So you're reading across a huge emotional dynamic that addresses a lot of different issues and topics. And you're not, and I'm not even realizing this because I'm, like, 11 years old, you know? Yeah. But you know, these are the characters I loved. And I also really, you know, I really love the fact that even though I didn't know how to express it at the time, that they were these, you know, kids from different backgrounds. You know, and Cassie and Axe were, like, my favorite characters. And Axe was the alien, and Cassie was black, and her parents were vets. So she was the one who owned the barn with all the animals, you know? And that was the key, like, oh my gosh, she had all the animals. And I do feel like that is a theme, you know. I also was a big fan of, I guess, like, children in peril. I think children just like reading about other children in peril, because when the children survive in the books, and they feel like they can survive in life. So I was also a fan of the Boxcar Children, like, runaway children from, like, a negligent, you know, home. But they all, and they live in a boxcar. And Gene Craighead George wrote all these survival books about, like, you know, this kid, he's in the forest. All he has is a hatchet. And somehow he survives. Or, like, I live in a mountain. I live in a tree. I find a deer and make a clothes out of its hide. Like, those survival stories. And I feel like my love of sci-fi fantasy and my love of and fascination with the survival story really does have ties to, like, what I identified a lot with as a kid, you know?
Well, one of the reasons I loved X-Men as much as I did as a teen, I guess preteen teen, was because they constantly spoke about the aspect of being marginalized. That was the overall world, even though you're talking about mutants. And, you know, mutants aren't real. I'm using quotation marks because you never know. But I don't think I realized, like you were saying, the deeper issues they're talking about. But you're enjoying it for some reason because you connect with it. And I think that's why I connected with X-Men, because I was like, oh yeah, they're not understood. I totally get that. And they're hiding, and they got superpowers, and But then, like, branching out into the larger stories, you still see, and, you know, with the Hugo Award, and, you know, Daniel, Jose Older, who we were speaking about earlier, is very vocal about that. And it comes up in the Geeks of Color panels of not seeing yourselves represented. So when creating the Geeks of Color, or organizing these panels, I should say, what was your bigger goal in terms of, like, connecting these communities? Because it's called Geeks of Color. It's not called sci-fi people of, you know, color. It's, like, just getting us all in the geekdom, kind of like the blurred community, the black girl nerd community, and all those things of just, like, getting us all who are, I guess, avid readers, big into pop culture, or just that we're all fascinated with something very specific that we can all connect to, I guess, kind of leads to the terminology nerd, geek, in that sense.
When I first conceived the panel for New York Comic Con, It was purely because it's like, oh, there are so many. I grew up in New England, mm-hmm. and a lot of the conventions, I actually didn't go to sci-fi conventions as a kid. I went to anime conventions, mm-hmm. because, again, anime was one of those media, you know, that I did see myself in. Like, oh, look, all these Asian people, they have, like, adventures, and they fight monsters, and they're mm-hmm. magical girls, and, you know, so, and I found that very interesting, mm-hmm. you know? And so I'd go to, like, all these anime conventions, which were, you know, in the overall scheme of things, like, not as representative, but a lot more than any other type of convention, like, you know, gaming, or, like, sci-fi books, because at least a third of, you know, of the attendees were Asian, mm-hmm. and, at least the Black fans, you know, were also very present, too. And if you go to, when New York still had the New York Anime Fest, or if you go to Anime Boston or Kineticon, you instantly see that, like, you know, at least, like, 40%, you know, or half even, of the people who attend are people of color. Mm. And people who say, like, oh, we have, like, a representation problem. Well, I think a big part of it is because, like, if you don't see, you know, yourself in the media, then you're not interested in going to a social event.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not going to find people who look like you. Mm. So... So at New York Comic Con, I thought it would be a great opportunity to have a panel, because already at New York Comic Con, there was a huge, you know, contingent comparison to anything else I've seen at other conventions mm-hmm. of fans of color anyways. Like, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be great if we just all got together and just talked about issues and talked about fun things mm-hmm. and talked about what it's like to work in the industry? Because there is still a, you know, obviously there is a, still a huge difference between, you know, the representation in fans and what you see in yes. creators in the workplace absolutely. For these creative industries. The first year I did Geeks of Color, it was strictly fan. But I had people who were fans that like myself, like, had major presences in the communities they were in. Mm-hmm. You know, and I drew people that were into tech, into comic books, into gaming, into cosplay, and then for the second, third years, and I think in going forward, what I really want the Geeks of Color, like, meetups and the panel to be is, you know, both, like, an empowering space, but also a networking hub. Mm. So that's why, you know, I prefer calling Geeks of Color as opposed to anything specifically focusing on community. Mm. So, you know, you could be into, like, comic books, or you can be into film, mm. or you could, you know, be an aspiring, you know, YA writer, mm-hmm. and hopefully, like, go into this room and see someone that you'll be able to connect with later on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And that has been representative, because you had Eileen Gregario, mm-hmm. who technically did not write anything sci-fi related, but she did write a YA book. Mm-hmm. featuring an intersex character, mm-hmm. and you had Daniel, who at the time his YA hadn't come out, but his adult sci-fi had right. come out, and Kay Jemison, or mm-hmm. Nora Jemison,
right.
and gamers, like you had said, as well as illustrators. So it did, like, cover a good realm, and I like the discussion because it was specific to the community, but it is people kind of geeking out.
Right.
and talking about, oh yeah, I love that, and that was my favorite thing ever, and so and so and so, and how they got into the community, which I remember a few of them had said networking mm-hmm. as well was a huge key factor.
Right.
And you had said that as well. So this being a good networking event, do you feel like also the allyship should be represented in that way too, because it's necessary since there are still the dearth in the numbers?
I like specifically for like events the networking. In general, or
yeah.
Oh, okay, like
I mean, I'm sure they attend the panels. You
right,
know?
Right. I mean, it was, you know, it was a huge variety of people who can't, you know, and it's always out the door every year, which is great.
But in terms of the, being present, but not necessarily being vocal, you know, like the role of allies,
right?
As speaking is, you know, be there, but don't necessarily speak over.
Right.
So in terms of, I guess, mainly the networking events in that sense.
So,
then. Because they can give those hands out.
So, and I think, the question of like the role of allies and, you know, and allyship, mm-hmm. You know, has also been like a topic of late, for several reasons. I think one is that everyone wants to be an ally, but I think in reality, when someone says, I want to be an ally, one, they may not know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they may use it for self-serving purposes. Three, they may be sincere, but they don't know how to, you know, they don't know how to be an ally without, you know, or you're right, without like, you know, speaking over or overstepping, mm-hmm. or assuming that, you know, some sort of, you know, savior aspect to themselves because they are the great ally. Like, mm-hmm. these people, they need to be like rescued from their situation. So that has been a topic that's come up a lot in the discussion of allyship. And the other aspect is people who are afraid of calling themselves allies because they don't want to be perceived that way. They don't Ooh. Want to be perceived as the white savior, or they're afraid of doing something wrong.
Mm.
So they're like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure if I can be involved because what if I do X or Y? Or like, and again, it's a fraught conversation because you have a lot of people of different intentions, and you have a lot of different power dynamics being navigated at the same time. And one of the key aspects of allyship really is to make sure all sides, you know exactly where the ally's place is. And sometimes the allies don't know, sometimes, you know, the people that they're trying to ally with, like, mm-hmm. don't know, aren't clear, or have conflicting opinions in their own community, you know.
That's very true.
So, but in general, I think when it comes in terms of allyship in specific situations, you know, someone can be, you know, more direct or more clear, and, you know, as long as like everyone knows, you know, what is the purpose of this,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knows like the existence of boundaries, mm-hmm. like where are the allies' boundaries, and the allies have to know this, you know, and, you know, before reaching out, mm-hmm. and I think that discussion doesn't happen often enough. In terms of very basic job hunting, networking, professional, you know, experience building sort of deals, I think it is a bit easier because the power dynamic is already really clear, the intentions of everyone is already really clear,
mm-hmm.
and it's not, and I don't think it's emotionally fraught for someone to offer a disadvantaged person material help if needed, as opposed to offering, you know, some sort of emotional or intellectual or resource guidance mm-hmm. for the long term,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And at least for, you know, in terms of like job hunting, it's much easier, you know, to say like, look, I can give you this, you know, this opportunity for you to interview for, you know, as opposed to like something that can have more complicated material questions, you know, such as like, what does it mean to like give aid in certain situations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I mentioned before, I would have never gotten any publishing experience if it weren't for scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, but again, that was, you know, that was from my undergrad with specific mission, really, in a lot of, you know, the ways that they approach their student body, mm-hmm. is to help, you know, to help women, in the greater public realm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, and, mm-hmm. You know, and that's what scholarship in specifically was available to, for anyone, you know, mm-hmm. with, an internship who needed funding,
yeah.
And you have, you know, and you still have to apply for it and stuff like that. But I think when it comes to, the role of allyship and the role of like, who has the power to give aid and what expectations come with it,
mm-hmm.
needs to be examined a lot more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that, because I think I'm also so jaded by my own experiences as a New Yorker that you know, hearing something like, oh, well, this, their mission was to specifically give women aid to do this. And it's just like, oh, people do that? Really? And people do that. It's not unheard of that people do that. But you're still like, really? Come on. You know, we have to fight for, you know, like every single little thing whatsoever. So with the We Need Diverse Books internship, the goal is, you know, just to pay for a summer internship and also to get that experience. Mm-hmm. And one person did end up getting a full-time job from mm-hmm. that experience. Do you think it's something that schools need to invest more in, or publishers and schools need to invest more in terms of helping to diversify? Because it's such a multifaceted systemic problem. I always say circuitous as well, because I really feel like it does go throughout, you know, every aspect of the industry, that it goes with the schools because people don't know about publishing as an option. Mm-hmm. And it goes with the publishers because how much are they diversifying or reaching out to schools or reaching out to clubs mm-hmm. or HBCUs or Latino specific, or finding LGBTQIA instead of saying, oh, well, we went to Columbia and Columbia's in New York. That should be good, right? The colleges, the publishers, and then, you know, the onus is on us to try and find the jobs. And with social media and Media Bistro, it makes it easier, but then you have 20 times more competition because mm-hmm. it's just like, oh, I can just email my resume. And then, you know, there's just so many issues happening. So do you think, at least with in a scholarship for an internship, or just paid internships, or the bevy of paid internships, is a start to recognize that people do need this money and it shouldn't be assumed?
Right. I think that is certainly a start. And I think more and more companies are recognizing the need to compensate, you know, your workers, mm-hmm. even if they're interns. Tor does have paid internships, by the way.
Awesome.
And we also actually have a program that is in partnership with, you know, a couple of local high schools, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, to get like high school interns that like may have interest in publishing experience. And for, you know, and since I've been at Tor, a good majority of them have been people of color, actually, awesome. From those high schools. So people are definitely listening, mm-hmm. and how proactive they are, you know, does vary across the board, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know? But the material, financial logistics, like, you know, that is like the bare basics.
Yeah.
That, right. And it's also something that can be easily quantifiable and justifiable to higher ups. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's easier to argue that, you know, possibly that we need like, you know, extra money in your budget for these positions, you know, so we can pay, you know, we can pay our interns, you know, and it might be, you know, a longer struggle to like establish your line of like of books that, you know, that that feature like prominently like people of color, or mm-hmm. just to have like a majority of your list, you know, feature and star people of color, you know, mm-hmm. that takes longer. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about Steeplejack. Mm-hmm. Steeplejack is your first YA acquisition. Congrats.
Thank you. Yes, it comes out this June. And I'm really just psyched about it. I don't, you know, did you want me to like toss out the nutshell
yes.
elevator pitch? Or?
Also, because it's when you were talking to me about it, you basically sold it, which proves your editor skills.
Sweet. It also proves my marketing skills.
Well, exactly. It's like, obviously, all of those years to this moment. And you sold the Jaded New Yorker a book. And I was like, damn, that sounds good. All right. I'm with you on that, Diana. I'm down with this. So it's from AJ Hartley. And you were talking to me about the larger elements of the book, mm-hmm. And it, I did, you know, key in on the word multicultural in the description. Yeah, it was just like, damn, this sounds really cool about the layered aspects of it. And then we were talking, then we started getting into another really cool discussion, which I feel like this will transition to.
Yeah. So to start from the beginning, the nutshell elevator pitch, which I didn't give you, but now I shall give the listener. Steeplejack is a murder mystery adventure that takes place in a fantasy world inspired by 19th century South Africa. So our protagonist, Aang, she is a steeplejack. And a steeplejack is someone who climbs to the top of chimney stacks, factories, church steeples, and repairs the brick. The very first night she's supposed to train her new apprentice, instead she finds him dead. At the same time, this historical icon called the Beacon gets stolen. Now all the newspapers are talking about how the Beacon is stolen and no one cares about brown kid who died in the street, except for one person, who's a politician who hires Aang to investigate her friend's murder. Mm-hmm. And so in her investigation, she, you know, realizes, greater conspiracies, more people get killed. The Beacon is made out of this glowing material that's a very rare mineral called Luxorite. Mm. And she realizes it's, you know, the importance of that in the whole gigantic plot. And when she discovers the truth that links her friend's death to the stolen Beacon, she has to reveal it before the city breaks out in riots.
Mm. And also you're talking about with it taking place in South Africa. I mean, South Africa, but you're saying the main character is South Indian.
You know. Yes, it's all fantasy. So like the analog is South Indian, and the city of Bar Salem, which is where the book takes place, is based off of the South African city that actually has the largest Indian population outside of India, and Aang, and Aang is part of the Lani community in the book, and the other groups are the Felsens and the Mwene. And so she's navigating between these three communities, her native, immigrant, Lani community, mm-hmm. The white, settler population, mm-hmm. In this quote unquote decolonized nation, which isn't really, mm-hmm. and in the black community, which is split between the assimilated tribes and the unassimilated tribes, who are the black tribal population that still live in the savannah. So it's a very complex, layered cultural dynamic that she grew up in and that she navigates in. And one of the fascinating aspects of the book is how she sees herself in this larger racial hierarchy where you're not black or white, mm-hmm. but you're still affected by it. Mm-hmm.
And that's always a perspective I'm so interested in because obviously I'm black, for people who don't know.
Ta-da!
Surprise! But also because I the learning, getting more familiar, understanding your privilege, things like that, understanding more about the other marginalized, like how can you talk about marginalization if you don't listen to other marginalized cultures? And asking if you think the Asian perspective, and then when I say Asian, I'm including South Asian, East Asian, perspective, do you feel like it gets lost in the conversation, particularly since diversity has become such a big buzzword in the United States?
I think oftentimes, race relations in general get reduced in, to black, white in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result, if you are still like a racialized minority, your status somehow becomes weaponized one way or another. For example, for the Asian American population, there is a stereotype of like the model minority.
Mm-hmm.
And because there is that stereotype, often the Asian American community is weaponized by the white community against all the other communities of color, saying, well, look at X group, compared to the Asian American population, which is also damaging and stereotypical because when people talk about the Asian community as like that mall minority, they are thinking about East Asian upper class, populations, mm-hmm. and the, you know, a good number of the Asian American community in the United States, you know, are not that. I'm not that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm Southeast Asian, and the Southeast Asian, you know, populations in the United States include, you know, Cambodian, Laotian, Hmong, you know, and Thai, like, these groups are actually some of the poorest mm-hmm. in the United States and mm-hmm. most disadvantaged, mm-hmm. but people don't recognize that because they just think, oh, if you're Asian, you must, like, you know, be exactly, you must have the exact, you know, same achievements as all other Asian groups, and that is not true. Mm-hmm. I think because, you know, a lot of minority groups, you know, outside of, like, the black, white binary, and I also include, like, multiracial people mm-hmm. as well, you know, I definitely feel like they can feel like they're lost in conversation, or they don't have a stake in it, or they, you know, they like, internalize the white supremacy, so they aspire to be white, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. And all that is equally, like, as damaging, and it doesn't help resolve, you know, race relations at mm-hmm. all. Mm-hmm. It doesn't foster, you know, understanding of what the real problem is. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's tricky because when it comes to creatives of color and what gets promoted or pushed in the media, there's always a critical dynamic that comes when any like minority, you know, prominent media gets pushed, you know, among other like minority communities, because there's a component of, you know, how much of it is a stereotype, how much of it is it not, and there's also a component of like how much is it that this media particular is being pushed as so great because it appeals to whiteness, mm. as opposed to appealing to, you know, their own community. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's just a huge, huge aspect, and I'm glad you touched upon all those points, especially the it's really hard to navigate in a lot of ways, because then I'll have friends who are Indian, mm-hmm. who are like, I can't stand the Mindy Project. Mm-hmm. It makes us look bad, or I can't stand this because it makes us look bad. Yet it is by a creator who right. is Indian.
Right.
But I'm not looking at it as an Indian American, mm-hmm. and that's a whole other switch. Right. And like you say, technically our perspectives have been very much molded by what we've been seeing, mm-hmm. which has been dominated by white culture.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, right. And you know, another example is Fresh Off the Boat. When before the show aired, there's a lot of controversy around the name, and Asian Americans, you know, were worried about like how much is it going to fall into a stereotype, mm-hmm. because it's called Fresh Off the Boat. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And on the other hand, once it came out, there was a segment, you know, that was like, oh, this is actually a funny show that isn't focused on stereotypes. That's great. But also the writer, those memoirs was based on the show, Eddie Huang. He was totally like, oh my gosh, you totally whitewashed my life.
Yeah.
You know?
They Disneyfied it, is what they did. They made it consumptive for a family audience.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I do agree, like, they definitely Disneyfied it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's also, yeah, it's also interesting to, like, hear those, you know, criticisms, especially when the showrunner is a person of color and the majority of the writing staff are people of color, you know, then what does that say mm-hmm. About the creation of a show by, like, minorities if you don't think it's actually for minorities, or is it? So.
Yeah. Well, also, when you look at shows in that manner and books, the fact mm-hmm. of the matter is you acquired Steeplejack, but technically, you know, you had to fight for it, and you have to go through all these rounds, and people are going to decide, you know, the marketing department is going to put their 2 cents in, and, mm-hmm. you know, and I've seen in my own job, in previous jobs, editorial lose those battles with marketing, because marketing's marketing and publicity is publicity. And I'm like, that's my job, and my job is to sell this book, and I know what I'm doing, and et cetera, et cetera. So in talking about the writer's room in terms of TV and other media, who's to say that there's not those similar elements of someone sitting there and saying, you have to do this, and I don't see it like this, or cut this, and did this, and then it becomes something. It's yours, but it's not, in a way. Just like books are, they are the authors, but there are a lot of outside elements. The editor, the designer, the copy editor, the production person, all these elements are coming in to make it a packaged deal to sell for mass consumption.
And I think what people don't tend to realize about book publishing, I always compare making books to putting up a theater show. That there's so many elements other than the actors on stage. You just may see the actors on stage, but there's so many people behind it that you don't recognize as being just impactful.
Exactly. So touching on this subject with Fresh Off the Boat. last week, first full week in January at this point, Nicole Chung, she's a managing editor at The Toast, she wrote a post about an experience she had at a dinner party being compared to the entire cast of Fresh Off the Boat, not just one person. Apparently, this person said, oh, you look like them, which is, you know, it was like all of them. And she speaks to that in her essay. I heartily ask people to read it. I posted it prior to when this podcast airs. And the title is What Goes Through Your Mind with Casual Racism. Specifically, her piece points to the pressure on people of color to keep the peace, not get mad, and serve as a quote-unquote teacher. And she spoke a lot about microaggressions, and some people may not like the term microaggressions or macroaggressions. They just feel like it's pretty jacked up regardless. And in her case, it was specifically tied to a social event, but this also happens in professional settings as well. I've experienced that. So being so enmeshed in not just the publishing community, but the fandom community, how often are micro and macroaggressions something you have to be aware of? And how do you tend to respond to these situations? I know at New York Comic Con, a lot of times things specifically talked about women being very on guard, being in cosplay, and how men approach women and things like that. But there's also when you're a woman of color.
I think there's a difference, first of all, between, you know, people of color experiencing everyday life and encountering all these microaggressions and trying to like put up a, you know, a good face at, you know, at social events. And I think there's also an element where, because I consider myself an advocate as well, like, when am I on as an advocate and when am I not? And so for me, I know I have different standards and boundaries than the average person should have, because I purposely put myself in a place where I could educate someone. But here's the thing, you don't expect every single person of color or person from marginalized background to be your educator. It's not fair.
Exactly.
You know? And so, and also, and still, like, you know, as an advocate, you know, an educator, I do get like those moments where people throw a comment in my face, and I'm like, you know, what are you talking about? You know, because it's, and that is a natural human reaction to act, you know, in shock when you don't expect a hurtful remark to be thrown at you, especially if you don't expect that hurtful remark to come from someone that you thought you knew. It's always a very tricky situation. And I think it also, you know, ties in to just the general idea that, I guess, of manners and politeness. And it's I'm gonna like draw on a steampunk example and why I, you know, think there should be punk and steampunk. It's because of X reason. And a lot of people who get into steampunk always cite, like, oh, people are so genteel and manners are important, unlike today where, like, people aren't, you know, as polite. And first of all, I'm like, well, you know, steampunks in general, you know, tend to be more respectful when approaching other people, mm-hmm. unless they're not. but, you know, but I also think that the politics of politeness was rooted in who had the most power in the situation, and you should always defer to the most powerful person in the room. That was the whole premise of why manners were created, why there is rules of politeness, why it was the servants who bowed, and why you always say yes ma'am or yes sir. Mm-hmm. You know, it was always about a power dynamic and mm-hmm. not about treating people as equals or everyone, you know, being worthy of the same level of respect. So, mm-hmm. so I mean, that's why I'm like the punk and steampunk is that, like, you know, you should, you don't have to hear about rules of politeness if they're based in inequality. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I think that if that's the mindset you have, you know, it's still a very tough emotional situation in general to, you know, to hold that position in everyday situations. Because no matter what, no matter how angry you are at the power dynamic, no one else realizes the power dynamic except for you.
Yeah.
So how do you react? Yeah. And it also really also depends on your own personal personality too. Like, am I pressured to be, the person who has to call everyone out, mm-hmm. even if like that is, you know, I don't necessarily have, you know, a personality that is always confrontational. Some people are very good at it because that's part of their personality. Some people mm-hmm. aren't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I do legitimately believe that people have different personality types and can feel more okay doing something one way or another way because yeah. that's the type of person they are.
Yeah.
And people shouldn't feel pressured to act like a different person in order to enforce some sort of political belief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, again, that's emotional labor. That's unfair to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that, at least for me, that's why I always defend, you know, other activists of color if their advocacy methods are different from mine. What I really dislike, especially in the steampunk community, doing what, you know, the stuff I do, is people comparing me to other steampunks of color and say, oh, I like you better. And I'm like, you are full of shit.
Mm.
Because the reason why is because I seem to be the nicer one. And that is not fair. And also, that means you actually did not learn anything.
Mm, interesting.
You know, and that's actually, you know, occasionally, like, I get, you know, because I do a lot of panels. And I, you know, I do know that I do public speaking very well. And I write articles. And so I understand, you know, there's a level that people feel more comfortable possibly talking about me of other things. But then doing it in ways are like, no, like, I accept you as part of my club. And I'll never tell it to actual other people of color. I'm like, then, and again, it's like, you know, what kind of circle am I being led into?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, am I actually challenging, you know, whatever internalized ism you have,
mm-hmm.
or am I just one of the good ones?
Mm.
That's actually something I think about a lot.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, it was also interesting because you're saying you respect the way other people advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting, too, because when Nicole was online, she talked about this on Twitter during the holiday, and I guess she built it up so much that she formed a really fully realized, wonderful piece.
Mm-hmm.
What was funny, and I don't mean funny, ha-ha, kind of funny, like, oh, of course, is that people were telling her how she should have reacted. POC, in the POC okay. community, in the non-POC community, is just saying, I would have. And I thought that as well. I'm like, damn, I would have totally said something. But understanding that she was very uncomfortable in that instance, and she was quite literally feeling as though she was the only mm-hmm. person of color. I forget if she actually was. I think she was. And her husband is there, and her husband is Caucasian. It was like that frozen moment where everyone's waiting for someone to say unfreeze or something like that, and that was her responsibility, and she said something and everyone said, oh great, okay, she's not pissed, great, we can move on now. And that was a lot of pressure on her. But then when you talk about it and the community saying, well, da 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 da, this is how I would have done it, this is how I would have done it, which isn't necessarily constructive, kind of like what you're saying, it's not necessarily helping, because then it may make her feel worse to say, well, I would have called them out and that's not her personality, and there's no one right way to react in this situation either.
Yeah, it's complicated because, you know, there were so many factors, you know, that the article addressed in particular. Like, you know, it's an intimate social situation. Mm-hmm. There's like emotional social dynamics. You know, I know some of the commenters pointed out, you know, if the commenters were white, who pointed out, like, I'm not sure I would have said anything because I didn't want to step over her mm-hmm. voice mm-hmm. and seem like a mm-hmm. white savior if I said something.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so there was a huge range of different reactions, mm-hmm. you know, and I think in situations like that, you know, and especially if you think about the greater context of the article, mm-hmm. was delineating how difficult it is to navigate those situations, you know, and I think the greater point really is that there's just more than one answer, and you shouldn't dictate answers to others, but mm-hmm. where should your sympathies lie? Your sympathy should lie with the person with the least power in the situation. In that situation, it was her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if there, you know, so like a very insensitive response to the article would have been to defend the person who like said the racist thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? So yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because my first thought was, dang, I wish someone had said something. Not her, but someone else had said something to take that
right.
burden off of her. And in a previous episode from last year, you know, talking to Ashley Ford about it, it's just a very interesting distinction, mm-hmm. depending on who you talk to. Because for her and for me alike, it was, man, it would have been nice if one of the allies spoke up and take that burden away from me. But for someone else, it might be, I hope no one says anything because I just want to forget about it, even though I'm sitting with this.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, it was really, really, really good. So thank you so much, Diana, for being on. And congrats on Steeplejack.
Great.
AJ Hartley coming out this summer.
Yep. Coming out in June.
June from Tor Teen. So how may people reach you? If you would like them to reach you.
I can be found through... you know, my multicultural blog, Beyond Victoriana, which is beyondvictoriana.com. I can be also found on Twitter and Tumblr. And the handle for both is Writer Syndrome, one word. And you may also, find me on tor.com. I don't blog as much there anymore because editorial kind of takes up your entire life.
That's a good thing. That means you're acquiring more books.
Right. So
I like to hear that.
Definitely. Thank you.
And check out the Geeks of Color panels. Like I said, they're on YouTube. If you Google Geeks of Color panel, those are like the first five things that come up are the YouTube.
You can also
videos.
See the videos on beyondvictoriana.com. We have a video section and so those panels and other panels and interviews mm-hmm. that are related to the blog are also there.
Awesome. So thank you again for being on and for your perspective. I think this was a really good conversation.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome.
My pleasure.
Yay. Take care.
Great. Thanks.